What are the crucial issues in the 2024 elections? What advice does the philosophy of objectivism have to offer in thinking about these elections and the issues arising in them? Welcome to New Ideal, the podcast of the Ayn Rand Institute. I'm Ilan Jerno. Joining me today is Onkar Ghate. Welcome, Onkar.
Hi, Ilan.
So I thought it's really important for us to talk about the elections that are coming up, and this is the first episode in what we anticipate being a series of commentary on what are some of the issues in the election, how to think about them, how we approach these issues. So I thought a good place to start is how the Institute approaches these issues, what we do and don't comment on. So maybe I'll throw that to you as a starting point.
Yeah, so we're not political in the sense of endorsing candidates, telling people how to vote, and we're given our mission and structure as a nonprofit. We're not to engage in that activity, and we don't engage in that activity. But we are a philosophical organization, a philosophical institute that exists to advocate for Ayn Rand's philosophy. And a philosophy, when we're talking about a system of philosophy, which objectivism is, Ayn Rand was deliberately a systematic philosopher. One branch of philosophy is political philosophy. The basic principles that should organize government and law. So a political philosophy has many things to say, many implications for thinking then about politics, about elections, one's also, from a philosophical perspective, one should be interested in the direction and trends, intellectual, cultural, political, in one's country, and that philosophy helps you understand those and then to try to shape them for the better. So we're interested in all these issues, even though we're not a political advocacy organization. Like, we don't lobby, we don't tell people who to vote for and so on.
Yeah, I think it's worth underscoring that. And as we'll talk about some of the issues today and in the subsequent podcasts and commentary we're planning, I think some of our viewers will be surprised at the angles we take and the evaluations we reach. And I think that's because objectivism is a distinctive, in fact, a unique system of thought. It doesn't sit neatly in any of the existing categories. So it's you're going to hear from us things that are critical of the GOP and of conservatives and of the Democrats and of liberals and of progressives and of libertarians. And it's not that we are critical of people for the sake of being critical because we're contrarians. It's because our views are highly distinctive and our positions cut across different of the conventional views. So take an issue like abortion, which is often seen as to be pro-abortion as a principle, as a right, is associated with being on the left or progressive or liberal. And we hold that position. We're more principled about this. We're more consistent about advocating for the right to abortion than even many people who are seen as on the left. And then take other issues like economic issues. We're for a free market, not in the way that Republicans or conservatives are claimed to be for a free market. We're for a laissez-faire, absolute capitalist market, an ideal that isn't realized in our existing society. So in that sense, that kind of perspective is associated with what is often seen as a conservative movement or libertarians. And in fact, we hold that position in a consistent and uncompromising way. And yet we're staunchly opposed to many of the positions that define modern conservatism and define libertarianism today. So we don't really fit in any of those categories. So don't be surprised or anticipate being surprised, I suppose, by the kind of positions we do take. And I'll say one other thing about elections this year and in past years, and this is to circle back on your point. I think it's useful to say that it's understandable that people often come to us, and I've had phone calls at the office with people calling to say, how should I vote? I need your advice. And I can't, as an institute employee, give you that advice. That's not what we do, as you said, Onkar. But what we do offer is, in my view, more important, because it helps one think about the issue. So, and I think this goes to what kind of advice philosophy gives. I think in some ways people misunderstand what philosophy is generally. They don't really have a concept in many cases. And insofar as they hear about philosophy, they treat it as if it were a religion or something that is just a set of dogmas. And that's not what objectivism is. It's neither a objectivism tells you to vote for this specific resolution or this specific proposal or this specific candidate. I don't think any philosophy can do that, because a philosophy is a system of principles and it guides your thinking. And that's part of the value that we're hoping to offer, is to help people understand how to approach these issues and then make their own decisions. And I think it's important that people do that. And it takes work, it's effortful. And that's part of our goal here, is to set the stage, set an agenda, and then guide people with the philosophy of objectivism towards making their own decisions.
It's worth pointing out that people were often surprised by Ayn Rand's positions on things, even knowing some of her views. They may have read The Fountainhead or read Atlas Shrugged, read some of her nonfiction essays. And yet when she had certain positions, they were very surprised. And just take some political ones. The libertarian movement that was growing starting in the 60s into the 70s, and it became a very political. People expected, well, like they talk about freedom. They sometimes talk about your novels and books and work, so that Ayn Rand would be in favor of them. And she was pretty adamantly, and I think a growing adamancy, that no, I repudiate them. They're not actually pro-liberty. They're too much on the side of anarchy and destruction. That was one element in it. And this surprised many, many people in the 70s. She articulated some of her reasons for it, but that's one position that was startled people. Another, fast forward about a decade, was they expected that Ayn Rand would support Reagan. And in one of her last appearances, she says something like, let me anticipate what I'm going to be asked in the Q&A, and what she's going to be asked for. She doesn't support Reagan. And she had reasons centered around the way in which he was bringing religion into politics and appeasing the moral majority. But if you're a real philosopher and you're thinking philosophically, you're thinking deeply about these issues. And there's, just to take one kind of thing that happens a lot and that Ayn Rand analyzed a lot, there's such a thing as masquerading in favor of X when you're actually adamantly opposed to X. And the arch example for Ayn Rand, I think, in her thinking, is she viewed Immanuel Kant as the most evil thinker in history. And he poses as pro-reason and pro-science. So I know many academics who think, yeah, but Kant's on the side of reason and science. How can Ayn Rand be against him? And she viewed it as a complete masquerade. And that happens in politics as well.
Our goal today is to talk about some of the issues on the campaign trail in the culture right now and that are important to think about. So I want to get to that. I just want to make one other observation about how Ayn Rand thought about these issues. You made the point just a moment ago, Ankar, that to think philosophically is to be interested in the direction of intellectual life and culture and to influence it in positive directions. And I think Ayn Rand was really committed to that in the latter part of her career, in the post-Atlas Shrugged years, when she was more focused on talking about philosophy and its application. I think for many people, it's interesting and also you mentioned her reaction to libertarians and to Reagan. I think it's interesting for people to go and look at her commentary on particular elections. And she did this, not every single election, but she thought certain elections really warranted commentary. Certain candidates she thought held certain promise. And one thing that impresses me about her approach to this is just, one, she learned a lot from doing it. And she, I think in some cases, she thought more, she expected more from certain candidates than they actually were able to deliver. And she observed that. But there's a real precision in how she's evaluating particular candidates. So this is more by way of teasing for people to go and explore. But it's interesting to go and look at her commentary on Barry Goldwater before the elections, and then after the election, she has a kind of a post-mortem on him. what it is she responded to, and it was surprising. It wasn't his domestic policy, in fact, his foreign policy, and then her analysis of why he failed is really illuminating. You mentioned Reagan. I think that surprises a lot of people. I think also her an account of Nixon, I think, is really interesting. And this is there's just a lot of rich philosophical analysis of particular candidates in general elections. So that's for people who want to understand how she approached it. And our goal is to take the principles of objectivism and bring them to bear on the issues of today. So let's turn now to some of the things that we think of as on people's minds, they're part of the debate. And then I think there's another category of things that should be, but aren't necessarily. So let's start with that. So Onkar, what would you say are some of the things that are really important that you're thinking about that I think a lot of people are engaged with right now?
Yes, and things that we will be talking about in the next 6 months in the run-up to the election. Well, one is just the Trump phenomenon, Trump as a candidate, the base that he's appealing to and leveraging, what that base actually seems to think, how they process things. I mean, I think of Trump in part, I mean, partly as he's representative of a growing tribalism in the country. But so putting it as a Trump phenomenon, it's not just Donald Trump as a candidate, but the appeal of Donald Trump. And I wrote about this when he was first elected for the Institute. And again, to take I think of the subject matter of, wasn't Trump the political candidate? And he had just won election. And I deliberately wrote the piece after to not even make it look like we're trying to sway people about how to vote. But it was the fact that he could win election running the kind of campaign that he ran and emphasizing certain issues. So that another big issue is immigration and his anti-immigration stand and the way he spoke about immigrants. And that could attract a sizable base. So in terms of thinking about the intellectual direction of the country, where we are, how people are thinking, to what extent are they being pushed into tribes? You have to think about the Trump phenomenon. And I have a pretty negative view of this phenomenon. And we'll talk about that. I actually think it'll be interesting to revisit that piece in light of the 5 years history or no, it's, I'm sorry, it's about 8 years history now. So that's one. And I'll just say that there's an expectation for other intellectuals and intellectual organizations that we would have a perspective on the Trump phenomenon as an intellectual philosophical organization. I met many people afterwards. So after we at ARI had done some things post the 2016 election on Trump, saying, yeah, in investigating you guys, so people new to the Institute or who want to do something, one of the things I looked at is like, what's your stance on this phenomenon? And they told me like they read the article. And we do the same in regard to other organizations and intellectuals. Like, how are they thinking about this? What is their stand in regard? So it's a major issue that it would be, if we didn't offer a perspective on it, there would, I think, rightly be, like, what good is a philosophy if it doesn't help you understand this phenomenon?
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's true of, I think, all of the issues that we tackle. Is that it's in part to primarily to explain the phenomenon, whatever, domestic, international. And in the course of doing that is to exhibit the value that the philosophy offers one. I think I think of it as it helps to unlock important issues that are hard and that a lot of people struggle with. I want to add something to what you were saying about, I think that's a great idea. I think it would be good to revisit that essay and talk about what you were arguing, what you weren't arguing. Because one of the things I remember about it, and it's, I guess it is now almost 8 years ago, but a lot of the reaction to it, I just want to put a pin in this, so something to come back to. A lot of reaction was people personalizing it to, why are you criticizing me for voting for Trump? And I don't think that was the point. Now, there might be people who voted for him for bad reasons or good reasons, And there's a lot to say about the reasons for a particular candidate, and that's something else we should talk about. But the point of the article was about the phenomenon and the appeal, and not the candidate and not the evaluation of people who voted for him, even if there are implications for that. But you would have to think about what those implications are and what the context was and who they are and what the conditions were. So that's not to say there isn't things to say, but it's that wasn't the point of it. And I think that it's interesting that that was part of the reaction. And the other thing I remember is that I read the piece when it came out. I read it numerous times because we got questions and it was an issue for people and they wanted to better understand it. But one thing that struck me is how loosely people were reading it versus what was actually on the page. So I think a good example of a highly emotional issue where it's harder for people to process. And that's something that I think is true of that. There's more than one piece on Trump, but that the first one in particular, I think, was just, it reminds me of how charged that environment was post 2016 election. How people really, there were people talking about they're going to move to Canada, they're going to, you know, cancel, give up their citizenship, things like that. So it's just an interesting moment. So Trump, yes, we'll definitely have discussion on that. You mentioned abortion, and that is just grown into such a big issue since the fall of Roe v. Wade, which is an issue we've talked about, and we need to talk more about it. It's so significant, and I think it's becoming more of an issue on the campaign trail. I think that's a good thing in it because it's so important. The worry I have, and again, today is more of a preview than it is a discussion of the topics, but one thing to flag for a further discussion is, it's not understood well enough as what exactly the striking of Roe v. Wade has done to individual rights. I think it's not understood the significance of it, and there's too easy a dismissal of the consequences. And the way I would put it more bluntly is, I think women are dying because Roe v. Wade has been overturned, and in many states it's next to impossible to obtain an abortion, including for the kinds of cases that the people who are opposed to abortion claim that they want to be able to allow so-called exceptions for. And I think that there's a lot to say on the issue of abortion, how it's processed. So we'll come back to that. Anything on this before we move to the other topics?
Yeah, I'll just say, it's important in itself, the issue of abortion. I mean, enormously important, but it also tells you something about the intellectual trends, the factions and groups. So something like what happened with the in vitro fertilization. So that tells you something about what their actual views are, that they so quickly want to distance themselves. Oh, we're not saying you can't do this. Well, isn't the logic of your position that you can't do this? And so is it really that you don't care about? So what is, if you don't care about the logic of the position, what is it that you care about? And that, and then thinking, okay, if that's what they care about, what other things would they do? How are they functioning politically, socially, culturally? There's a lot to learn. And that's, again, from Ayn Rand's analyses, that's often what you get. You get illumination both of the more concrete issue, but then, well, this tells you something about their whole way of facing the world, their whole worldview, which has implications far wider than just the abortion issue. And that, in terms of philosophic commentary on political issues, you want to be looking at both of those things. And we try to look at both of those things in analyzing the issue.
So let's talk about the economy briefly. And this is something a lot of these topics are things we will come back to either in their own dedicated podcast or as part of other conversations in the coming months. I think the economy is something I would like for us to do more on in general, but I think that there's things we've done that touch on this. So a couple of aspects here. One, inflation, I think, is a major issue in the elections right now. And I think we bring a distinctive view to that. Our expertise is not in economics. I know you have some, but as an organization, that's not where we define ourselves. But the issue that I think is important about understanding where the inflation phenomenon is and how it's understood is how it's understood and how it's deliberately misunderstood. And I would flag here the way in which it's been disconnected or disintegrated from the recent history of what's happened in America. And I think the biggest issue that has been disconnected from inflation is COVID and the effects of locking down society for so long in such a authoritarian way, and then injecting so much money into the economy that's just, that has to be a reckoning with that. And I don't think there's been an honest reckoning with that in the way that I've seen people discuss inflation. So I think it's something to come back to. Any thoughts on that?
I think of the economic issues in general of they're symptomatic of a kind of cultural shrinkage that has happened, that the discussion of the economic issues to the extent that they happen is so concrete and there's not even a whiff of a principle involved in the discussions. And I can remember back 30, 40 years, it wasn't like this. So part of the reason to think a lot about this is, I mean, economic issues in and of themselves matter a lot, but they also tell you something about the cultural trends and what is going on intellectually, educationally. And as a result of thinking, like, where is the country headed? If, yeah, as you said, if you can lock down people, halt economic production for that long, and there's not any real discussion afterwards of, like, was this good or bad? Should we ever do this again? It warrants real analysis.
I remember when, right after the midterm elections, I guess it was 2 years ago now, we discussed some of the races and the outcomes. And one of the issues that I remember flagging is how little discussion there was about the pandemic, and then not just the economic ramifications of the lockdowns, as you're saying, also the issue of maybe this is a once in a generation, maybe once in a century kind of pathogen. But the idea that you wouldn't spend time and you wouldn't campaign on, let's never let this happen again. Let's use our best knowledge to put in real mechanisms, real thought and preparedness. And one of the things we've said during the pandemic is that the preparedness for it was abysmal. And that's a real dereliction of responsibility on the part of the government. So to me, the pandemic connects to the economic issues in general, but just as an issue, it defined my children's youth for sure. It impacted so many children in schooling. And I don't think we've even come close to reckoning with the full impact of it. But just to think, we just went through almost 2.5-3 years worth of significant disruption in economic activity, in business, daily life, the 6 feet distancing from people, the masking and all of this. Why isn't it not discussed? And I think that there's something disturbing about that. I mean, imagine going in a personal trauma and never talking about it. And it's something comparable in my view. I think there's a lot to say about that. The fact of its absence, I think, is really revealing on that issue. Okay, there's a number of other things we should be talking about in the coming months as well. So let me flag them and you can respond to the ones that you want to address. So a couple more just to list them off. Biden's energy, Build Back Better, and Green New Deal, all the attempts that were part of the Biden agenda that we talked about in part, but we'll talk more about. And I think it's important to think about those issues because one way to think of it, it's the mainstreaming of environmentalism, which in our analysis is an ideology, not a scientific phenomenon, not primarily a scientific phenomenon. And that mainstreaming of that view is disturbing and disruptive, and it became a big plank of what Biden's doing. And so it's important to think about that issue. A couple more just to put on the table. Foreign policy. It's right now it's Biden suffering because of his support for Israel. That's one of the narratives you hear. It's not clear that foreign policy is an issue except insofar as it's going to cost votes in one way or another. There's no vision, I think, articulated by anybody about what foreign policy United States should take. And this is, again, in the shadow, not that long ago, of the Afghanistan withdrawal. This was under Biden. What are we to make of that? How does that shape our future thinking about foreign policy? What is the lesson of that? And I don't think there's been any significant thought on that. We've said a lot about that. We think it's significant. Ukraine, Iran, the Gaza war. And then I think the other thing just to flag, and I'm particularly interested in your reaction to this one, I've thought about it as a kind of cultural shift towards a readiness to protest. So I don't think protests are inherently bad, but I think we've seen in the last 10, maybe 20 years, a growing willingness and larger numbers of people going to the streets for on a host of issues. So not just the BLM protests or the responses to the murder of George Floyd, but also things around COVID during the lockdowns. There were instant protests all over the place. And then most recently in reaction to Hamas's attack of October 7th. So I think there's a shift in this culture of protesting in the streets. And I think that's a significant change that it's not a campaign issue, but I think it's a cultural issue that feeds into how to think about the election. So I put a lot of topics on the table. Let me get a couple of your reactions to that.
Well, on that last one, I would say a theme that will run through our commentary and analysis, because it's an essential, is tribalism. The way in which, and it you can think of it as it's going in both directions, that tribalism as a mentality infects all the ways the particular issues, abortion, immigration, the economy, and COVID are talked about. And the way they're talked about helps strengthen tribalism. So, and I think of the something like the protest movements as falling in this, as in this, and you can think of it as a downward spiral or a vicious circle of tribalism is more openly about gangs, my gang right or wrong versus your gang right or wrong. And so you're not open to persuasion, rational communication, discussion. It's whatever my tribe says, that's what goes. And whatever your tribe says has to be wrong. That's not a, you don't have any real rational discussion left. And if that is really what you're descending into, then what you would resort to is, we're going to get our group out and show we're the bigger group, and we're going to get our way because we're the bigger group. We're the dominant group. That, like, it's tribes competing with each other, but they're competing with each other not on arguments, but on sort of the mass of bodies and strength. And so tribalism pushes, like, that's what we're going to do. We're going to mass protest, demonstrate, and we should get our way because we're the biggest group. But the way in which this then pushes other people to be more tribal is when that is shown either to be effective, or at least the authorities don't do anything about it. And like the Black Lives Matter protests during COVID, when we were supposed to be in lockdown, and these are allowed to happen, and with very little pushback and protest from the authorities, and so like, you're not supposed to be doing this. That teaches other people, oh yeah, so I guess the way to get what we want politically is not to try to argue and with legislation, so we have to go on the streets. And that's the way in which it comes from a tribalist perspective, but it encourages tribalism. And to see that dynamic, and I think that kind of dynamic is going on with most of the issues that are either the ones being discussed or why some issues aren't being discussed. You have to see the influence of tribalism in order to really understand what is going on. So I think that, as sort of running through many of these issues, will be important to discuss.
Let me put it on the table, the last issue that I think we should be talking about, and we will have more coverage on this. We've already done a number of podcasts across the last few years on this topic. I think of this as the assault or the persecution of so-called big tech. And I say so-called because I don't accept that tag. I don't accept that term. I think it's loaded and inherently pejorative. And when we were preparing for today's conversation, you pointed out something that I thought was really important, which is we're not in a place where it's a debate about should there be prosecution of Apple or Amazon or Facebook or Meta. It's there's agreement on it, and then there's disagreement over details, or that in effect, I don't know that there's even disagreement over the details. It's become a bipartisan issue. And I think of it as a convergence that it's hard to find people who are questioning this whole approach. And important to identify here is it's the convergence of two kinds of threats. One is economic, one is intellectual. One, and this is something Ayn Rand talked about decades ago, it's the push to implement antitrust legislation, or antitrust rules against these companies, or the threat of doing so, and the pressure on them in terms of what speech they allow, what speech they themselves are free to exercise. And this, I think, is, and the most recent example of this is the case against Apple, which we talked about a week or two ago. I forget when it was announced, and we'll be talking more about this. So it's not about particular companies, although it's important which companies are being singled out. It's the more successful ones that are inherently the targets. This is a significant issue. It has only gotten more significant over time. And I think our perspective on this is distinctive and important, and it has to be part of how people think about the direction of the country, the direction of politics, and what's discussed and what isn't being discussed in these elections 2024. And to me, this isn't discussed. It's a crime that it isn't discussed. And I think and we'll talk more about the reasons why this is unjust, but I think to put our perspective here just in terms of a headline, this is a persecution, not a prosecution. I think it's important to understand it in those moral terms.
Yeah, and it's important to see that issue as it impacts other issues, and it tells you something about the way people are thinking about other issues, in particular economic issues and American productivity, that there's many people who pose as, yeah, we want to see America prosper. We want to see wages going up. We want to see productivity going up. But if you're on the side of prosecuting and persecuting America's most successful companies, the companies that stand out across the world, Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, if that's your target, that's who I want to go after and help undermine, dismantle, destroy. It's a pose, it's a masquerade that you care about American prosperity, the American economy. So it's very telling. It's enormously destructive economically. Just if these companies are hampered, it's gonna harm the American, anybody who's productive in America. It's gonna decrease your productivity. But it also tells you something about the whole mentality. Like, do they care about making America great again? Do they care about productivity and America flourishing? And you can't, when you take your best exemplars and say, well, these we're going to destroy, you don't actually care about it. And that, so it's again, like it's an important issue in and of itself, but it also tells you something about the mentality you're dealing with.
So let's draw a line here. This, our goal was to preview some of what is important to think about, important to talk about, and to preview what we will be attempting to cover in the coming months. Let me say a bit more about that. So as I said earlier, we plan a number of podcasts to pick up on some of these themes and topics, and we will start unrolling that with a particular focus in the rundown to 2024 elections. A couple of other things we're planning to do, and we welcome your input. So we'll have a Q&A around this. I think I expect to do something around this with our donors at a special donor event coming up. The other suggestion you brought up before we went live, which I think is really helpful, is we'd love to hear from everyone watching. What would you want to hear more about? What kind of topics you want to hear discussed? What things do you find challenging? Send us your comments, your suggestions. You can reach us newideal@aynrand.org. We always want to hear from you on that. And then the final thing I'll say that we're planning to do, in addition to these podcasts and other commentary in the run-up to 2024, We will also have podcasts, at least one, right after the election to try and unpack what happened. Whichever way it breaks, it's not that we're vested in a particular outcome. We want what is best for the United States and for freedom and for our own lives. But it's important to understand, I think, the election result and to see what actually drove what. And I think it takes a lot of work to think that through, because it sets the tone for the coming 4 years, in many cases, and maybe longer too, depending on how the election plays out. Okay, so that's the plan. We have a series of podcasts coming, some Q&As. We welcome your input, and we will be back here next time. Thanks everyone for being with us. Until next time.
You've been listening to New Ideal, a podcast from the Ayn Rand Institute. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast was made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to AynRand.org/membership.